It is a privilege to be here, passing on to you not only the teachings of my wonderful teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to all of the great ancestors all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So the subject of today and next week is the personal vow of Kosho Uchiyama. And Kosho Uchiyama is the Dharma heir of Sawaki Roshi that we talked about last week and last 2 weeks. And the personal vow of Sawaki Roshi, Dharma for the people, I think probably everybody remembers. So this is basically, when I say triumvirate, Sawaki Roshi is the grandfather and Uchiyama Roshi is the father. And then Okamura Roshi is the son. And Okamura Roshi is connected with two other very interesting, closely connected with two other very interesting people that I thought I would throw in here. But so today, we're talking about the Dharma heir of Sawaki that we all know Sawaki really well. He's pretty easy to remember. Religion is to develop the most refined and distilled life attitude. Kosho Uchiyama took this for a motto. Religion is to develop the most refined and distilled life attitude. And at the same time as he took that as a motto, he took two personal vows based on the four general bodhisattva vows. And one of the two was to study what he called the truth of life from the perspective not only of Zen and Buddhism, but also from other spiritual traditions. This is unusual. And to digest it through his own way of life and to share it through his writings with Japanese and Westerners alike. His other vow was to produce determined practitioners of Zazen who are thoroughly settled in the life of Zazen practice. So he has several things going on. In the background, in the very background of the four bodhisattva vows, beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Or you can even say, I vow to become one with them as I already am. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. The Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Those are the four bodhisattva vows. And then on top of that, so those are in the background, whatever. And in the foreground are his two personal vows, one to study the truth of life from the perspective of all religions. And secondly, to produce disciples thoroughly settled in the life of Zazen practice. And on top of all of this is a very beautiful and true, I think, belief. Religion is to develop the most refined and distilled life attitude. So then regarding his story, in his own words, he says, I grew up in Japan during the Taisho era, which is 1912 to 26, and the first 10 years of the Showa era, 1926 to 89. By the Western calendar, I was born in 1912, and I graduated from college in 1935, these are his words, and stayed on in graduate school for another 2 years. The earlier Meiji period, which ended in 1912, was an era that worshiped everything that came from the West. But during the Taisho and early Showa periods, Japan began to appreciate its own historical roots. And at the same time, the political scene saw a rise in ultra-nationalism, culminating in World War II. And Uchiyama says that, in other words, politicians took what should have been a natural pride felt by the Japanese people in their own cultural richness and manipulated it, which is really true. So then he goes on, from the time I was in high school, I never took the slightest interest in nationalism. My eyes were always drawn toward a much larger world, and it has always been my dream to come up with some ideas that might be helpful to other people around the world. I think that's very interesting for a young boy to be thinking of helping people around the world. I dreamed about coming up with a new idea for some origami figure that people anywhere could fold and enjoy. My father worked on topographical models as part of his work, and he was an expert in origami. And this is Uchiyama. I suppose he first learned origami from his mother, just as I did. And it was from my grandmother that my desire to create things through origami grew. By the time I was in college, my interest in creating new origami almost got out of hand. I invented a number of folds to make different shapes and created a style of making almost anything, flowers, animals, automobiles, Buddhas, by folding just one square sheet of paper. There's something very Zen about this, I have to say. It's I think it's amazing and ingenious and generous for someone that young to think of helping people around the world. It's quite something. We don't know so much about origami over here. It's kind of a specialty. But he was deeply involved. So he says, this is just an interest I had within the world of pastimes. Far more serious for me was my concern with the overall theme of my life. This came to be centered on the question of what the self is. And I wrote about this in a book entitled Jiko. This Japanese word Jiko means universal self or whole self. We live simultaneously as a personal self and an individual taken up with everyday affairs and as a universal self that is inclusive of the entire universe. When I use the phrase universal self, I mean it in the sense of a self that is living the whole truth of life. Trying to understand and live in terms of this reality has been the overarching theme of my life. So basically, that's Zazen. Zazen is about becoming one with dependent co-arising. In other words, losing this idea of a self as you enter into a larger, interconnected, ongoing, arising idea of all beings. And so what he's really talking about is, he's saying Zazen has been the overarching theme of my life. That's basically what he's saying. You'll understand this more as I proceed. So while he was still an undergraduate, he met his first love and they were together during these years. But after 4 years, she contracted tuberculosis and died. And this was not uncommon in Japan, but so this is death number one. And then He signed on to teach mathematics at a Catholic school. And while he was there, he thought he'd learn about Christianity, and he began studying with the priests at the school. But after only half a year, he became disillusioned, quit, returned to Tokyo, where he met another young woman whom he had known from childhood. So he married again. And again, his new bride died in childbirth, as well as the child died. So we've got already three deaths now. So after consulting with his father, it was decided that it would be good for him to meet Kodo Sawaki Roshi. And so after listening to Sawaki Roshi give a Dharma talk, he realized that the only way he could possibly understand the Buddha Dharma would be to become a monk and practice it. So on December 7th, 1941, that would be December 8th here, really, he was ordained as Kosho Uchiyama, novice priest. And during the war, Sawaki Roshi, knowing that Kosho was not physically strong and would certainly be unfit for the military, sent him to various places where maybe he could be just kind of overlooked. So in one tucked away prefecture, he spent his time making charcoal, and in another one, he spent his time making salt. And 1 week prior to the end of the war, he was actually drafted, but then the war ended, so he never had to get trained. After the war, Sawaki Roshi sent him to a monastery, Jippo, G means monastery, so Jippo-ji, monastery, where he stayed for about 3 years. And then in 1949, Sawaki Roshi became the new abbot of Antaiji, where we know this from last few weeks, and called all his disciples to join him. And at the time, Japan was still suffering from the ravages of the war, and the Antaiji was sort of had a lot of squatters. But when Sawaki Roshi took over and established a routine of daily zazen and study, which, as we know, is very severe, most of those squatters that were residing there just left. So Kosho Uchiyama stayed at Antaiji from this point until, so this is 49, until his retirement in 75. And Sawaki Roshi was such a severe teacher that the only disciple of his who stayed with him was Uchiyama. So Uchiyama stayed until Sawaki Roshi's death in 65, and then he stayed another 10 years. As we know, Sawaki Roshi was there for the monthly sesshin, but traveling and teaching most of the rest of the time. Sawaki instructed Kosho to, since he didn't have much money to pay for a funeral, to donate his corpse to the Kyoto University Hospital and then have them use that for research. But the point of that really was that in the Japanese tradition, once a body is cut up, you can't have a funeral. So Kosho did that, and there was no funeral. But what he held instead was a 49-day sesshin at Antaiji, and anyone who wanted to pay their respects to Sawaki Roshi could come during this 49-day sesshin and just sit for however long they wanted and join Uchiyama Roshi, who was sitting this sesshin. So in his words, "My early years at Antaiji were as hard as my homeless wandering years, but I continued my search for a true way of life. For me, understanding the universal self is inseparable from Zazen. So in my book, Jiko, I talked a great deal about Zazen. It was in this book that I first used the phrase, opening the hand of thought. It seems to me that Zazen is the highest form of human culture. And this opening the hand of thought became a very famous phrase, and many, many people used it. And it's Uchiyama Roshi's original phrase. And Uchiyama continues, I describe two sides to a person who practices Zazen. He's talking about what he wrote about in Jiko, his book. So there's two sides to a person who practices Zazen. One side is the personal self that's always being pulled to and fro by thoughts about desires. And the other side is the self that is sitting in Zazen, opening the hand of thought, just letting go of thoughts. And this is the ordinary person living out the universal self. And the first side, the personal self, is like clouds. And the second is like the wide sky that the clouds float in. And I wrote, this means I wrote in my book, Jiko, he's saying, when we look up, and this is such an interesting, I've never heard this before. When we look up and we tend to think that the clouds mount high in the sky, but I read, Uchiyama says, I read that if we draw an 8-inch circle to represent the earth, the pencil line is the thickness of the entire atmosphere. The clouds are mist things floating here and there, appearing and disappearing within that thin space. Ever since I've heard this, I drive home and I look at these gorgeous, fluffy, mounting sky clouds, and I just try to picture that this is one thin pencil line. It's actually one thin pencil line. It's really hard to imagine that. And then he goes on, rain is just something happening under those minuscule clouds. But when rain keeps coming down, we think the entire sky is nothing but clouds and raindrops. But in reality, the atmosphere that is only as thick as a pencil line, there is always above that, there is always blue sky and the sun is shining. But we cannot even imagine that. How pitiful we living beings on the ground here are, he's saying. In the same way, we are always coerced with dark clouds of anxiety and sorrow, caught up in the storms of anger and ambition, encounters with agony and despair. However, the clouds and rains of our thoughts are only happening within a pencil-thin atmosphere. This mental weather is simply happening within our thoughts that seek satisfaction. Outside of that sphere of thoughts, the sky is always blue and the sun is always shining in it. When we can sit immovably, like the encompassing sky, we can view and experience storms like pain and sorrow without being overwhelmed. And this idea of, in Zen, our thoughts are considered the obstacle, the main obstacle to our seeing the truth of the interconnectedness of all beings. Basically dependent, we dependently co-arise with all beings constantly. And it's our thoughts that keep us from seeing that. So that's what he's saying here. Zazen, he continues, Zazen is precisely the posture of sitting in the sphere of absolute peace of mind that is like the big sky in which the many clouds of thoughts come and go. However, no matter how much Zazen we do, poor people do not become wealthy, and poverty does not become something easy to endure. We're not doing Zazen to create a result. Zazen actually does Zazen for Zazen. That's all. Zazen does Zazen for the sake of Zazen. After his teacher's death, Kosho finally became abbot of Antaiji for the first time and was addressed as Roshi. And he often joked about he had to be in his old age before he became, you know, he was still a novice until his old age. But when Sawaki Roshi died, Uchiyama vowed to stay at Antaiji for 10 more years to write texts for ordinary people. He reminds you of Sawaki. He's going to write texts instead of just go around homeless to whoever invites him to give Dharma talks, like Sawaki Roshi did. So Uchiyama's going to write texts for ordinary people and raise young people to face the 21st century, which means teach them how to do Zazen and become settled in a way of life of Zazen. So he retired from Antaiji in 75, and he and a third wife, who was an ardent student and an ardent disciple, they moved away. And then they moved again to a small hermitage, Nokkeien, in Kohata, a district in southern Kyoto prefecture. And during Roshi's final years, he often spent several months a year in bed with a type of tuberculosis, and his wife looked after him carefully so that he might continue writing texts as long as possible for the next generation. And finally, in 1998, he died. He just passed away quietly after an evening walk. So in his book, he says, "What I want for you, the reader, is that you understand with your own intellect that Zen concerns the true depth of life that is beyond the reach of that intellect. This life is not Eastern or Western. It extends through all humanity. I hope that as you read, you'll look at your own life with a completely fresh mind and apply what I have written to your everyday life. That is the only place where the real world of Zen is. That is our everyday life." Sawaki said the same thing. I would like to turn now and get a little more specific about Uchiyama and his vow, vows, plural, made two vows. And he often used the expression, this is Japanese, Ichiza Nigyo Sanshin. And the first word, Ichiza, means one sitting, referring to Zazen. Nigyo means two practices, so vow and repentance. And Sanshin means three minds. And that refers to those mental attitudes of Dogens, joyful mind, parental mind, and magnanimous mind. We talked about those. So one sitting, two practices, three minds. One sitting is Zazen, two practices is vow and repentance, and three minds, joyful, parental, and magnanimous. So according to Dogen, our sitting is not part of our practice, but rather our other activities, are part of our Zazen. So this is what is meant by the phrase, our Zazen is absolute. This is a very important point. In Bendoa, I think it's maybe the third book. It's the third book that Dogen wrote after he returned from China. He said, and this is a very famous quote I'm about to make, and it's mind-boggling, but he's very well known for this phrase from Bendoa. Dogen says, even if only one person sits for a short time, because this Zazen is one with all existence and completely permeates all time, it performs everlasting Buddha guidance within the inexhaustible Dharma world of the past, present, and future. In this sense, sitting is absolute. This means that we become awakened to the reality that we are one with all beings, all times, and all space. So this too is the meaning of one sitting. And I think this is a very grandiose statement that only Dogen can make. But Dogen has his thumb right on the core truth of Zen. He just understands it. And when he says something like that, you can just believe it all, you know, you don't even have to think it through. But it's an amazing phrase. So according to Uchiyama Roshi, Zazen has two aspects. One is vow and the other is repentance. And in this context, aspect doesn't mean that there are two parts to our Zazen. It means that the whole of sitting is the practice of vow and at the same time, the practice of repentance. So whether or not we are aware of it, we are living out the reality of life. Unfortunately, we lose sight of this reality. And our life is like a hand. When we see it as a hand, there's no distinction between the fingers. But when we see it as a collection of fingers, each finger is independent and has its own name and characteristics. Each has a unique shape and function. They can act independently and are not interchangeable. But in the same way, human beings are individuals. We're like fingers. If we cut off a finger, it can't function as a finger anymore. A finger always works with other fingers. This is the reality of human life as well. But we often forget and think of ourselves only as individuals. This is a fundamental delusion for us. We have to wake up to the reality that we can be a finger only in relationship with other fingers, working as one hand. The hand can be a family, a sangha, a society, a whole universe. Yet if we think of this community as an entity in itself, it becomes just another bigger ego. We shouldn't consider it either the hand or the finger to be a separate independent thing. It's all this one continuous dependent co-arising energy. That's Buddha nature, and that's all beings. That is the fundamental truth. That is what Uchiyama Roshi is saying. The whole truth of the self is that. But because of our thinking mind, we are blocked from actually experiencing it. It's right behind our thinking mind. And that's why in Zazen, opening the hand of thought and just letting thoughts come and letting thoughts go without grasping is so important. And people think, oh, I just sat and all I did was have thoughts the whole time. But if you let them go each and every time, then you had a perfect period of Zazen. It's not about not thinking. It's about letting your thoughts go. So opening the hand of thought is a beautiful phrase and expresses perfectly what Zazen is about. Although this is the reality of our life, we are almost always unaware of it. We think of this person, which is ourself, as most important, as the center of the universe. We need to return to the reality that exists before egocentricity arises, before the separation of this body and mind from the rest of the world. So when Uchiyama says we are living at the intersection of the universal self and the ego-centered self, this is what he's talking about. To vow to save all beings doesn't mean that we believe that we have the power to help all those who are in trouble. And so imagining that would be very arrogant, he says. To save all beings means to be one with all beings. That is, it really means we realize that we already are one with all beings. And that's why we study the obstacles that prevent us from seeing this reality. And the obstacles really are our mind and our thoughts. This is how we become free from delusion. To become free from delusion, we have to study the Buddhist teachings. And reality itself is also a teaching. All beings in this universe, trees, leaves, animals, teach us to awaken to the reality that is impermanent and egoless. So even like his three deaths right in the beginning, you know, one, two, three, one wife, two wives, the second, and one son dead right off. So he got a dose of impermanence right away. He says we're not sensitive enough to hear this teaching without effort, so we must actively listen and study. In our practice together, we vow to attain the Buddha's way, the Buddha's enlightenment, and to be one with all beings. And in Buddhism, repentance does not mean saying I'm sorry because of some mistake I've made. That kind of repentance is relevant, but as Buddhists, repentance means awareness of our imperfections and limitations. And so vow and repentance are two kinds of energy that enable us to continue our practice. Zazen itself is the practice of vow, and Zazen itself is the practice of repentance. And one way of thinking about this repentance is, since we can't really do the four bodhisattva vows, they're beyond doing. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. We vow to realize it, but knowing that we will never be able to realize it. And therefore we have repentance. That's why repentance is so important. So when we sit, we face the absolute, the infinite, and we can let go of thought. And this means that we don't judge things by our own yardsticks. Instead, we're measured against the absolute. So that's our practice of vow and repentance. And facing the absolute, we really are nothing. So no matter how hard and long we practice, we can't be proud of what we've accomplished. At the same time, we don't need to feel guilty or inadequate because we can't practice enough or we can't help others so much. No matter how great or small our accomplishments, there's in this, they are all compared to the infinite. So that point, the point is that even if it's only a small thing, we just do it. We just sit a little, we can sit, we just sit a little more, or we help others a little more, but we should we have to be down to earth. And this is our practice. It's a very down to earth practice. And not to feel, oh, I can only practice Zazen for this tiny amount of time. Never mind, you still practice for that tiny amount of time. And my thoughts are racing the whole tiny amount of time. Never mind, you bring them back, you bring them back, and you bring them back. I want to end with a poem that Uchiyama Roshi wrote on the last day of his life. And it's called Just Bow. Putting my right and left hands together as one, I just bow. Just bow to become one with Buddha and God. Just bow to become one with everything I encounter. Just bow to become one with all the myriad things. Just bow as life becomes life. That was his final poem, completed on the last day of his life. So here are some of the most important points. First, the Japanese word jiko means universal self, our whole self, that we live simultaneously as a personal self, an individual with everyday affairs, and a universal self that is inclusive with the entire universe. So he says, when I use the phrase universal self, I mean it in the sense of a self that is living the whole truth of life. And I'm just add that that means dependent co-arising. Secondly, for me, Uchiyama, understanding the universal self is inseparable from Zazen. So in my book, Jiko, I talked a great deal about Zazen. It was in this book that I first used the phrase, opening the hand of thought. Third, Zazen is precisely the posture of sitting in the sphere of absolute peace of mind that is like the big sky in which the many clouds of thoughts come and go. However, no matter how much Zazen we do, poor people do not become wealthy, and poverty does not become something easy to endure. Fourth, Uchiyama Roshi often used the expression, this Japanese expression, Ichiza Nigyo Sanshin. And Ichiza means one sitting, Nigyo means two practices, bow and repentance. And Sanshin means three minds, joyful, parental, and magnanimous. And one sitting, he says, is the center of our Zazen practice. And lastly, fifth, According to Uchiyama Roshi, Zazen has two aspects. One is vow and the other is repentance. But they're not side by side. Each one is the whole of Zazen. So in this context, aspect does not mean there are two parts to Zazen. It means all of sitting is the practice of the vow, and at the same time, the practice of repentance, whether or not we are aware of it. And whether or not we are aware of it, we are living out the reality of life. But unfortunately, we lose sight of it. And here are some points for reflection during the week. First, his motto, religion is to develop the most refined and distilled life attitude. In your own words, what do you think this statement, developed by Uchiyama Roshi over his whole life, means? Religion is to develop the most refined and distilled life attitude. Secondly, Uchiyama coined and constantly used the expression, opening the hand of thought. To what do you think that refers? What is that? What is that about, opening the hand of thought? Because it's about Zazen, but it's about you every minute, probably. We're always thinking. Third, to save all beings means to be one with all beings. I used to think it means to save people from all beings from suffering. This idea that it means to be one with all beings, which we already are, is, I like it much better, but I have to get used to it. So to save all beings means to be one with all beings. We cannot become one with others by means of our individual effort, but we can wake up to the reality that from the beginning, we are one with all beings. That is why we study the obstacles that prevent us from seeing this reality. This is how we become free from delusion. If you can, consciously make Zazen a special focus for 1 week. So I'm suggesting that this week, to add, you know, even if it's just 5 minutes to your Zazen practice, just consciously as a gesture of removing these obstacles of thought, racing thoughts. Fourth, each of the four bodhisattva vows is a kind of paradox or contradiction. It is impossible to accomplish or completely achieve those vows. Since we are working at something infinite and absolute, it's important to reflect on the fact that we can never accomplish it. We can't be perfect. This awakening to our own imperfection is repentance. How is this different from your former understanding of repentance? People have a lot of ideas about what repenting means, and a lot of people are turned off by the idea. But in Buddhism, it means an entirely different thing. So how do you see the difference? And finally, Uchiyama says, it seems to me that Zazen is the highest form of human culture. So please comment on Uchiyama Roshi's very unusual statement that Zazen is the highest form of human culture. And how do you think that's different from the quotation that's his motto, religion is to develop the most refined and distilled life attitude? What is the difference between that and Zazen is the highest form of human culture? I wonder if there are any questions.
Thank you, Gail. The first question that we have is, when Uchiyama Roshi says the whole truth of life, as in when I use the phrase universal self, I mean it in the sense of a self that is living the whole truth of life. I don't think I understand what he means.
I'm really glad that you asked that question. You know, sometimes in early Buddhist texts, there'll be Shariputra or some who's the disciple of Shakyamuni Buddha that is foremost in wisdom. So Shariputra was the wisest of all of the disciples. And often it's said that Shariputra asked the Buddha some question when an assembly meets and the Buddha gives a Dharma talk. And but it's pointed out that Shariputra already knows the answer, but he's asking on behalf of all of the whole assembly so that they get to hear the Buddha expound on this question. So Shariputra is generously framing a question that he knows everybody needs to hear the answer to from the Buddha himself, even though it's really not his question at all. And I had this question has a ring to it like that. I'm not saying it's not your question, but it has that ring of, we all need to hear the answer to this question, so let's just ask it. And the answer is that it's important to remember that in Buddhism, there is this personal self and universal self too. They're both alive and well, and they both are interchangeably living at all times. They're arising and coexisting and falling off. There's just this constant energy of arising and falling away between the personal self and the universal self. And so we all know what the personal self is. It's what we do all the time and every day. It's our everyday life. And each of us has distinguishing features that mark us as unique. That's part of the personal individual self. And then the universal self that reflects the whole truth of life. In this sense, we're not the person that we think we are. We think we're, you know, Gail. I'm Gail, and I write poetry, and I give Dharma talks, and I whatever. But that's not how it really is. There's no I. There is no I. And so there's only the dependent co-arising with all other beings, constantly, dependently co-arising. There's this constant so that we're all one family. In the sense, all beings of all times, we're just all one family. We all are interconnected with each other. And it's when I do something, it affects everyone. It affects all beings in the whole universe. Everything shifts when I shift because of the deep, intricate interconnection. And so it's all the more scary when we have something going on like the Ukraine. And every single being that's affected there, we are also affected. And that's how it is. So living the whole truth of life is living your life from this perspective, not a selfish, greedy, angry, ignorant perspective. It's living from a perspective that how to benefit all beings. And it's very hard to live our life that way. But that's the truth of life. That, so when he says the sense of the self that is living the whole truth of life, he means the truth of the interconnectedness of all beings. Actually, he means the impermanence and interconnectedness of all beings, that truth. Everything is impermanent and everything is interconnected. And those two things really fit together. The impermanence, you know, flows into something else, and that flows into something else. And so that's how it, that's, so that's what that means. I hope you understand. It's those two concepts, which are really one, impermanence and dependent co-arising, are the two most important Zen concepts to understand. Those are the two most important Zen concepts, impermanence and dependent co-arising. That dependent co-arising is a little tricky phrase. It's like a tongue twister a little bit, but just picture it though. You dependently on others arise and disappear, and arise and disappear, not just you, but everyone, and all things, insentient and sentient. So that's what the whole truth of life means. If you live your life without ever giving thought to that, you're not living your life. You're not living your whole life. And that is not an understanding of your whole self. That's what he's saying. And I think you probably already have a feeling for how his life, as you know, based on writing texts to say this and creating Dharma heirs who will live a life steeped in Zazen, that you can already see his vow. You can already see it, that his whole life is his vow, which is the point of this Dharma talk series, that you're making also your own vow. So, okay, thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So we got a comment. I feel personally as though this talk has articulated so well why I left Christianity as a path and turned to Eastern philosophies and finally to Zen, particularly how you define repentance, the paradox of the Bodhisattva vows, and even the paradox of personal responsibility and being connected to all beings. I don't have a question. I just wanted to comment that I connected very much with this journey and feel grateful for this talk.
Thank you. And you know, I too, this content that we're covering in this series has helped me personally so much. I feel like I finally really kind of get the heart of the matter. And even though I can't say that I've personally experienced this dependent co-arising, I still feel closer and closer to it. It's not a mystery to me anymore. And I too feel really grateful for this material. And I'm so appreciative of your saying that. It just means the world to me, frankly. So thank you very much.
Kiel, so the next question that we have is, when Uchiyama Roshi uses the terms defined and distilled, what is he thinking? Is Zen refining and distilling?
Yeah, right. What's all the defining and refining and distilling? What are we distilling out? And you guess what? We're distilling out the ego. We're distilling out the self. We're distilling out constant thoughts, all of which are the obstacles to our seeing actually experience, seeing is a little, it preferences sight as one of the senses over, you know, we have six senses. So, but anyway, refining and distilling ourself so that we can actually experience how we are deeply, deeply, deeply interconnected with all other beings. More, if you're going to err on the, just err on the side of more deeply. Don't err on the side of, oh, well, it's probably not that. It's probably is that and double that. So that's what the distilling is all about. We're distilling the ego out of ourselves. And it reminds me of when I was writing poetry, and you know, in the years where I was peaking as a poet, I was very, very aware of what a finished poem meant, is that there was no me left in it. There's no me here. And then that's what a finished poem meant. There's no me in there anymore. And it's interesting that this is what Buddhism is doing with the human being, body and mind. Buddhism is distilling out the me in our body and minds. And it's the same as what I did in my poetry practice. It's really, it's very clear. But you know, I think I'm running out of time and that there's not time for another question. And so I want to thank everyone for being here, and also my team, Brendan and Brian and Sahar, for making here possible. And I hope I'll see you next week. We'll talk again about Uchiyama Roshi. Bye-bye.